Damon Duquesne is our next speaker. He's the project manager of Health Equits Program, a New York City project since 2006. In his role as project manager of Health Equits Program with the Primary Care Information Project, he has been responsible for practice recruitment, data collection and analysis, quality improvement, and provider engagement. Prior to his work with PCIP, Mr. Duquesne worked as an epidemiologist with the Bureau of Communicable Disease, investigating antibiotic-resistant pathogens. Mr. Duquesne received his Bachelor in Science and Master's in Public Health from the University of Michigan. Go Blue.
I love that. Thanks. I appreciate you guys giving me the opportunity to discuss some of the programmatic work we're doing with electronic health health records at the New York City Department of Health. My talk's going to be a little bit different. Sadly, I'll be talking a lot about quality measure data without actually presenting much data at all. So unfortunately, I haven't a lot of graphs, but there's the hope of graphs to come in the future. I don't have any relationships to disclose. So the reason why we don't have a lot of data right now is because when we first started thinking about what we wanted to do for APHA, we're right in the beginning of this program, the Health Equits program. We're collecting baseline data. And what we thought is that we wanted to do is do a data validity study to see if the data that we're collecting from participating practices, the smoking status data, smoking rates, data from the participating practices mapped well to the neighborhoods that they're in. We're working with community health centers. And we assume that the data that we're getting from these guys is the same as the neighborhoods that they're in. So we wanted to check to see if that was going to be the case. This is part of a citywide pay-for-performance program that is incentivizing practices to increase their intervention rates, smoking intervention rates with their patients. As I said, it's called Healthy Quits, and it's made possible thanks to the Communities Putting Prevention to Work grant made possible by the CDC. It's a provider-focused pay-for-performance program that targets large community health centers all throughout New York City that have adopted electronic health records, specifically eClinical Works. And like Dr. Avery, I'm going to have a neat little demo of our eClinical Works system, so I'm excited about that. Doctors are incentivized to provide smoking cessation interventions in any one of three ways. They can provide prescription drugs, counseling, which is the 3 to 10 minute counseling, or greater than 10 minutes in counseling, or referral to what we're calling a fax to quit helpline. What's interesting about our program as far as pay-for-performance programs goes is that it's a little different. We're not paying for every intervention. We're paying for improvement on interventions, and that comes into play a little bit later. In other words, we want to see you improve over your baseline. Doing the same thing over and over and over isn't good enough. We want to see you get better at your smoking intervention rates, because smoking intervention rates across the city by providers is really, really low. So we want to incentivize them to be better about what they're doing. So we look at the baseline levels from the previous year. We're going to see them give it above that, and once they start doing that, that's when they can earn money for their practice in this program. Some of the collaborators that we have are the Bureau of Tobacco Control and the Primary Care Information Project. The Primary Care Information Project at the New York City Department of Health is primarily responsible for helping small practices and large practices all across New York in traditionally underserved areas adopt electronic health records and help them utilize and learn how to use them so that we can hopefully at some point reduce health disparities. Some of the goals of the program itself are to increase identification and treatment of tobacco users by 25% by March of 2012. Essentially, that translates to treating about 18,000 additional smokers, smokers that have never received an intervention before. 18,000 is the goal number. We also want to change provider behavior. By that, I specifically mean that we want to help providers become more comfortable talking about smoking cessation intervention. It's tough. I mean, a lot of providers find it really difficult to talk to their patients about this. It's a sensitive topic. But we also want to help them utilize their electronic health record. The level of tech savvy of all of our providers, the hundreds of providers that are involved in this program, is really varied. A lot of them have really good adoption, really quick. They know how to use it. A lot of them are really having trouble with the mouse. So there's a lot of different things that we need to work with them and them. We also want to evaluate the efficacy of pay-for-performance in general. There's a lot of mixed reviews about whether this actually works. This isn't the only program that we've got going on at the New York City Department of Health right now. We've got another one that focuses on cardiovascular risk. And the data's still out. It's still pending. We don't really know if incentivizing providers is actually going to get them to change their behavior. And if it does, is it going to be a long-term effect or is it just going to be a short-term effect? As I said, we have large community health centers that are participating in the program. Specifically, we have 23 community health centers all across the city, and they serve a high proportion of Medicaid recipients by definition. And we're really excited about that because Medicaid recipients smoke at a much higher rate than the general population. In New York City, it's 19.2 versus 14%. But the other good thing about Medicaid patients is that they can receive excellent cessation benefits. Specifically, they can receive 6 months of smoking counseling, or 6 sessions of smoking cessation counseling for free over a calendar year, and they can receive 6 months of prescription drugs to help them quit smoking too. So it's a really great opportunity there. It's a big pool of people that we can draw from for these interventions. Now, these 23 community health centers, they're pretty diverse in their makeup. Some are very small. They've got one site, they've got a couple providers, but some of them are huge. They've got 14 sites, they've got 100 providers, so it's really diverse. So we've got 153 different sites for these 23 community health centers all throughout the 5 boroughs, which basically gives us a patient population of over 400,000, and we estimate over 77,000 of these individuals are smokers. So it's a big pool that we can get this 18,000 new smokers from. So as I said, it's a pay-for-improvement program, so we had to pull baseline data. So we pulled the baseline data, and this is what we got. We looked at an average smoking rate of all of our practices of over, a little over 21%, which is kind of surprising. That's a pretty big jump over the 19 that even you would expect from Medicaid. But then when you look at the range, it's huge. The max is 76%, but you've got a min of 0.08%. That doesn't really make any sense. What neighborhood, what clinic really only has a smoking rate of, you know, a tenth of a percent? So what's going on there? We have to compare that data. We need to see if it's valid. We need to understand if it actually makes any sense, which we kind of guessed that it didn't. So the great thing about New York is that we've got a gold standard that we can automatically compare everything to. The New York City Community Health Survey is a yearly telephonic survey of 10,000 adults that self-reported based on the CDC's National Behavioral Risk Factor Surveillance System. And essentially, it gives a lot of data on chronic diseases and behavioral risk factors of all New Yorkers, well, or at least of these 10,000, that we can hopefully break down by neighborhood, which is really great. And so then what we can do then is compare the data that we're getting from these community health centers and compare it to the neighborhood that these particular centers are in. So that's what we did. Now, part of the reason we had some max, I didn't quite mention this before, is that that max was so high is that we have a lot of practices that are serving special populations. We have a lot of clinics in homeless shelters. We have a lot of clinics that are involved in substance abuse and things like that. So what we wanted to do to make this analysis fair is we wanted to actually eliminate those out of the group. We wanted to pull those out and look at mostly primary care settings, community health care settings. So we pulled out all those guys, and then we mapped them to the particular neighborhood that they're in, and then we just compared their smoking rates. And this is the data that we've got. So you'll notice the first big thing is a big drop. 21% was where our original rate was. On the left is our participating practices, and on the right is the community health survey or the neighborhood practices or the neighborhood rates. So it's a big drop from 21 to 13%. Huge. But what's interesting about this is that not only did it drop before and after, but it also dropped to below the neighborhood levels. That's kind of strange, because it kind of flies in the face of what we would think about normally about community health centers. They serve the community that they're in, so you'd think they'd be relatively close. And this is a significant difference. But you'll also notice that the range is really different, too. Again, we've got a max of 76% and a really, really low minimum, whereas the range for the neighborhoods themselves is a lot tighter. Looking at more specifically, we've got 63 sites. Of the 67 sites that we were able to pull out, 63 were significantly different, but 51 of these, the vast majority, were much, much higher, had much higher smoking rates than the practices themselves that are participating in this program. So neighborhood, much higher smoking rate than the practices that are serving the neighborhood. Really, really strange. So the question is, why is this the case? And we think of the lack of documentation. We think of the lack of participation in the program. And we think there's a couple different reasons for that. One would be workflow. You know, we started this, you know, when we were submitting for APHA, this is like a year ago. So we've learned a lot of things since then, so that's why I'm kind of switching the gears a little bit with this talk. But essentially, workflow has become a big thing. Doctors got a waiting room full of people, and they're not, you know, they don't have the time to collect the data and in the structured fields, which I can totally understand. A lot of them like to go back, and they like to free text their notes because that's the way they've always done it, so they type that in, but that's not captured. If you're not collecting your data in structured data fields, your data is not captured for the purposes of our program or the purposes of meaningful use or a lot of these other things or in the quality measure registry polls that you might do on your own side. And so, but to give you an idea, there's hope yet, to give you an idea of what we're looking at. This is the a progress note of eClinical Works, which is one of the main programs that most of our community health centers are using. This is just a screenshot of the main progress note. And if you look over to the right, oh yeah, and this is not HIPAA stuff either. We're good on patient data. This is a mock-up. On the right here, you see our clinical decision support tool. So just like Dr. Avery's pointing out, there's an alert that pops up. Well, these pop up, these are demographically based alerts that pop up depending on your patient. You can see that there's alcohol use screening, cervical cancer screening. At the bottom, there's smoking status. So if you click on that little plus sign, it changes, and you get a little drop-down that says tobacco control. If you click on that little button there, up pops the smoking status smart form, okay? Really pretty. And then what you do is you've got that first question at the very top. Are you a current, former, or never smoker? If you click on current smoker, then you get the drop-down of all these other questions, such as how many cigarettes a day do you smoke? Are you interested in quitting? These sort of things. You answer all those questions, you click save, and then you're brought back to the main progress note. And one thing I didn't get a chance to highlight is that all that data right there is populated, which is really nice and handy, so you can see it every single time your patient comes in. But then what you also notice, too, is that alert goes away after you've done that. Now, what will pop up next, which is more relevant to the intervention side of things, after this is a smoking cessation intervention thing, little drop-down thing that you can click on and then do an intervention after. But for the purposes of this, we're just talking about status. So even though that's only about 4 or 5 clicks, and it only took me a couple seconds to run it through, it's a monumental effort when you're thinking about patient load and talking about a lot of other heavier issues, according to the docs, than smoking cessation. Okay, so this is a lot of work. So what we need to do when we are trying to get good quality data, we're going to try to get these groups and these physicians to start utilizing the electronic health record more, as it requires a top-down tailored approach. By top-down, I mean we got to get the administration involved. Because if the administration isn't leaning on their providers, then we're never going to get them to adopt these approaches. It's a tailored approach, too. As I said before, you know, some of these practices are very small. They have fewer providers than all the people in this room. And so I can go and I can sit with them at a desk, I can show them where to click, I can kind of walk them through the process, answer any of their individualized questions that I want. But a lot of them, we have 15 sites with 700 providers, and I can't get to a third of them, you know, by the time this program rolls out. So it's a big problem. So we got to figure out ways to help them root that. One of the ways we're trying to help with workflow is involving medical assistants. If we can get the medical assistants to do the screening while they're taking vitals, that helps with the workflow a lot. It takes a lot of pressure off the clinicians, and they can focus on doing the intervention themselves. Okay. Partnerships are also really important too. You know, part of making it really comfortable for a doctor to talk about smoking cessation is motivational interviewing training. I have no expertise in that, but we do involve the New York State Cessation Centers involved in that. That's pretty much all they do, and they're really, really good at it. And we can help. They can help us with that. So we've got some obvious next steps, some obvious evaluation things. Did we reach our goal of 18,000 new interventions? I'm going to tell you right now, we're not even going to come close. It's not even going to come close. We're at about 1,200 right now. But that's way up from what we were seeing before. So we've seen some really big improvements. And frankly, I'm excited about the improvements that we've seen. We're not going to get to the end. The CDC is going to be a little upset about that. But, you know, we can show demonstrated, documented behavior change with our clients and with the people that are participating in the program. We also want to assess the impact of the engagement efforts. What was it? What did it take for this particular clinic to actually start doing the work? You know, was it the progress reports? Every quarter we send out a progress report that says, you did this many interventions, which is so and such above your baseline, and you earned so many dollars, which is great. But then we also tell you, you all could have earned $3,000, but you didn't, and you missed out on those opportunities because you didn't do the work that you're supposed to do. That's a big motivator for a lot of small clinics because every little penny counts. It's so funny you should mention that. It is so funny you should mention that. We just rolled that out last week. So a lot of, you know, trying to assess what it takes to get a provider, to get a clinic really involved are big things that we're working on. I'd like to thank the EQUITS team, Dan Gottlieb, sitting in the third row, big contributor to this program. Really appreciate that. Obviously, our people at Tobacco Control and the New York State Cessation Centers. That's all I have. Thanks.
Excellent. So it looks like we have about 15 minutes. So raise your hand. No. And if you would be so kind as to tell us who the question is directed to. I just launched my chart, so which is the Tether, I think what you're talking about. I've not heard that term. And that's a feature that's just being rolled out where you can log on and see your own record.
We're actually working on that where we are, and we've looked at different ways of doing it. People talk about chips and carrying around things. We're actually looking at using the cloud in the future so that people can have their PHR available wherever they want. So that depends. Making it interoperable, I think, is still a challenge. Even though, like, we're on Epic, you're on, there's still, although it's all HL7, it doesn't really talk.
Yeah, our biomedical informatics department, you know, it's doing a lot in public health informatics, so they are doing some work on, you know, not so much the narrative part of the note, but, you know, flow sheets, immunization, records, things like that, and also practice portals, maybe one way to do that. There's a Harlem Health Promotion Center, which is also doing a fair amount of getting records and information into the hands of clients.
I apologize for ducking out. There's a cell-free zone here for NIH, and apparently it's not working. But I don't know if you've mentioned this. Any of you have received outside funding or the reason I bring this up, I don't know if I'm in the Office of Science Policy at NIH, but NIH is funding behavioral economics research. There are opportunities with CMS for the Center for Innovation. Is getting $10 billion. They're already, it's $1 billion a year. And one of the things that they're supposed to be looking at is, I should say more than one, slices of what you're doing. And I would just encourage you to do that. And then on quasi-governmental, I know it's in a different session, the CORI has funding. And that's the Patient-Centered Outcomes Research Institute. It's PCORI.org. I really urge you to go inside. They're looking for reviewers and people who are looking for funding, and one does not exclude you from the other. It's different than the NIH's procedure. So, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Dr. Ivy, for you, how were you handling people who were self-reporting anonymous testing as opposed to having been tested through your system? Did you still say you wanted them to have a test in their record?
We did. The providers have the option in the health maintenance reminder to override the reminder, and so they can document that it was previously done. But some did. We have not gone back and accounted for that. We could do that, but that would take a whole other person and a lot of time. And in fact, one of the things that is especially true in HIV is that HIV testing is that patients will report they got tested and they really haven't, because there's a misunderstanding between having your blood drawn, talking to your doctor, and thinking that you've had everything done and not realizing that there's a book this fat of every test that could be done. And particularly with HIV, up until 2008, recently, you had to go through pre-test counseling, post-test counseling, not assigned informed consent, but a lot of people still did informed consent. So many, many, many patients we see in all sorts of settings in Cleveland thought they'd been tested and never had. So we just encourage everybody to get tested regardless. Yeah?
My question is for the gentleman in the middle. I'm very bad at names.
That's a good question that you bring up. The other pay-for performance program I mentioned, the cardiovascular one, did have a control group where some were paid for their participation, others weren't. But in our case, we didn't really have enough money for that to get enough people involved so that we could have a control group.
Oh, okay, because you
NHS survey for the neighborhood, and then the other one was the participating clinics in the practice, or in the program.
Okay. Other questions?
Dr. Young, the results of the type 2 diabetes is really obviously exciting and shows the potential power and impact of EHR. I was wondering if there are any conditions that there might be more barriers for that might not kind of have that mimic success, like Dr. Hudson spoke about, some uptake issues with certain specialties and subspecialties with docs. What might those be, and how might those barriers kind of be dealt with?
I think in terms of uptake, we have empiric evidence that sort of the more subspecialized departments are sometimes the more resistant to using the EHR. And sort of if we look at the steps at which it's been implemented and brought online across our hospital, at least, it's always been the specialties that say we're special and we have some special thing that we have to do, and therefore we can't possibly use this generic EHR because we have our own special way of recording everything. Yes, I mean, I think that's the major hurdle of resistance that I think has been observed at our own hospital.
If I can add, I was very interested in this because HHS has funded, they put out solicitations on case they wanted input on the adoption, or actually dissemination and adoption of comparative effectiveness research. And they specifically called for at least two case studies of CER where it was contradictory or potentially lowering the physician income. And this study has just concluded, and I believe the RAND Corporation is going to be releasing it in the next couple of months. It's publicly funded, so it's open to everybody to see once it's out. But keep your eyes open, because it's very interesting. And one of the things they looked at was CPOE as one of the areas.
Other questions? I have a question for Dr. Young. How often did you do provider reports for individual quality measures? Or did you provide those?
We did, and we've done it once or twice, so kind of annually. But it's going to become now part of our recredentialing process, because the hospital and most organizations are looking at individual provider level data in terms of quality outcomes. So it's going to, the diabetes care is ultimately going to be mixed in with patient satisfaction data as well as clinical data.
And I think that what we found is that that's a very powerful tool to improve providers' behavior. It's that, wait, I look worse than everybody else. I don't want to be so slow closing my chart or giving a pneumonia vaccine. So we're competitive by nature, I think.
We are competitive. So we've actually talked about, we're divided into 5 teams with different colors, spurring the competition between the teaching firms, if you will, at the health center.
That's great. Other questions?
I don't know what I'm asking. So I have a question with regard to, and it's for any of the board. There are systems out there that have been using EHR for a long time. Kaiser and VA are like two sort of leading edge. Have you done any comparisons of what, I mean, we got some historical, but I'd like to hear whether compared what you have to findings coming out of those places. Anyway.
We have a project that is, I'm peripherally involved with, that's looking at diabetes and heart failure outcomes and hypertension across the greater Cleveland area, called Better Health Greater Cleveland. You may have heard of it if you're involved in health IT. And that has been looking at Kaiser, Cleveland Clinic, University Hospitals, and our FQHCs, as well as our health system, Metro Health. And that's been, I think, another kind of competition between practices and just adoption of EHR spurring a lot of these process improvements, because you can measure it and monitor it once you know how to get your data out of 17 different areas or request it the right way or know that when it comes this way, you're getting the oldest value, not the newest value, and so it can be tricky.
Yeah, having that information available real time is amazing and powerful. You can actually change behavior and then you get an instant. So that's a challenge, is we need to get over that lag time, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're right, physicians, healthcare providers are competitive by nature.
But I think one thing I learned was that we have to make the distinction between the data that we extract for our registry so we can look at the population versus the data that needs to be there on the desktop as the clinician seeing the patient. And, you know, they're the same, often they're the same data elements, but one needs to be displayed in one way and accessible and usable in one way. Whereas registry data needs to be usable and accessible in kind of another way. And I hadn't, before I started trying to do this, sort of made that distinction, even though I do both things.
One of the other things I think is interesting, and it kind of goes to Damon's talk with the e-quits, for those of you who have or haven't used an EHR, is when you put things in those categorical boxes, they often become fixed.
Yeah.
So every time you see the patient again, and if you're writing a new note, and trust me, documentation, you've got to include all these things, it pulls it in automatically. So over time, adoption does save provider time, but in the beginning, it can be very challenging. So you know, we're fortunate that we've been using this for a long time. We just went live on the inpatient hospital side 2 years ago, so I got to see the implementation phase in that arena, which I didn't get because I'd been away from the hospital when we were doing outpatients.
Usually the hardest part is getting the data in. Once the data is in, it starts to work better.
Exactly, exactly. And the data is only as good as the person putting it in. That whole garbage in, garbage out is very true. So we have 2 more minutes. Yes, in the back. Dr. Hudson, a very last one.
Sorry. That table that you showed us, what is significant with chi-square and logistic regression, did you run separate analysis for all of them, or was that all in